This is the sound of PCJ.
Media Network Plus. Produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perron.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to the program. Coming up today, we're going to focus our attention on the important role radio plays in countries where infrastructure has collapsed, places like South Sudan. Canadian Janice Law spent 9 months working in South Sudan, and she'll be joining us to talk about how shortwave radio in this country and many others actually saves lives. We also have a small contest, so get your pens and paper handy to take down the details. Media Network Plus, bringing you some sanity in this insane world. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
Morley Safer's 60 Minutes on CBS television in the United States last Sunday announced the death of veteran American journalist Mike Wallace.
Mike died last night at age 93. For more than six decades, four of them on this broadcast, he was a kind of one-man truth squad, a man with a remarkable gift for getting to the very core of a story. Villains of every stripe were his specialty. He could charm them into coming on 60 Minutes and, with his audacity, get them to reveal their villainy. More than anyone else, he was responsible for the continuing success of 60 Minutes.
Wallace began his career in 1939 as a newsreader on WOOD in Grand Rapids, Michigan. After World War II, he joined the CBS radio network and was at the beginning of the early days of CBS television. In the 1950s, he hosted everything from variety shows and game shows. It was not until 1959 that he joined the current affairs unit, and people started to take notice of his interview techniques. Mike Wallace was a pioneer in the ambush interview by asking questions that most journalists at the time would not ask. This aggressive style made many of his questions more popular than the answers themselves. Like in 1979 when he told Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini that Egypt's president thought he was mad.
And he calls you, Imam, forgive me, his words, not mine, a lunatic.
This type of question was also targeted to people that he liked, such as an interview that he conducted with Nancy Reagan.
You're going to be in Japan and I'm told it's a $2 million 2 weeks.
They're getting... two of us, they're working us like crazy. Now you really didn't need that question.
Mike Wallace, dead at age 93. Last week we told you about the $115 million cuts taking place at the Canadian Broadcasting Service. The service hardest hit is the international service, Radio Canada International. RCI's budget is being slashed by 80%. That means a $10.3 million will be lost annually. Two language services are being lost, along with both the English and French newsroom. RCI is getting out of broadcasting and will focus solely on the web. What is this going to mean for listeners who rely on radio? Wojtek Wjazda is the head of the RCI Action Committee.
If we're no longer broadcasting, what that means is we've just shut off access to the Chinese to uncensored Canadian news and uncensored world news from us, because our website, the RCI website, is censored, is blocked. By the Chinese authorities. In this context, we honestly don't know what's going to happen. Unfortunately, it looks like our public broadcaster was in this very difficult situation in terms of dealing with the budget cuts. Unfortunately, they don't seem to have understood the importance of Radio Canada International. And I think this is something that we should bring up, because a lot of people in Canada don't know.
Details on exactly what will happen at RCI are still unknown. Gviazda was interviewed last week on the International Radio Report in Montreal. He said that over the next few days, the RCI Action Committee will have more detailed comments on what will be done to try to help RCI maintain its international mandate.
The RCI Action Committee will start having some comments on our blog also. I think when you start seeing the reaction of people who use our service, who care about Canada, who want to have more information about it, who can't imagine a radio world, an information media world without Canada's presence internationally, then you kind of go, oh, they're kind of, you know, it's a little bit like comedians and actors and that have to go to the United States to be appreciated.
Right.
I mean, we're not really good at blowing our own horn. And this is one, and we don't do propaganda. Our job is not to give all the good stuff. We've even been criticized by our listeners. Why are you giving all the warts and all? You
right.
know? And so, but I think it's really crucial that people realize that it's like, I mean, we are one of the, we have a lot of advantages in Canada. We have a lot of experiences. We're a multicultural, multilingual country. People can learn a lot of stuff from us. And they can learn it in a context that they can understand by listening to us.
Shortwave, satellite, and all broadcast programming on Radio Canada International will end June 26th. CNN, Al Jazeera English, and National Public Radio in the United States have each received awards for their exceptional coverage of the Arab Spring. The broadcasters were among 38 recipients at this year's Peabody Awards, which recognizes excellence in broadcasting around the world. Al Jazeera English was praised as the network of record for millions of viewers throughout the world. Judges said the channel's on-the-ground reporting was thorough, enterprising, and brave. CNN was commended by judges for its preparedness and seasoned correspondents already stationed throughout the Middle East. The BBC won two prizes, including one for BBC.com, the global-facing version of the corporation's website, which judges said was uniquely situated to provide immediate, evolving coverage of news events, great and small, with access to more than 2,000 journalists and the BBC's 72 overseas news bureaus. A BBC Panorama documentary, Somali, Land of Anarchy, which saw Peter Gress return to the country after 6 years to help provide the world with an unflinching look at the life in the failed state, also picked up an award. And with that look at some of the headlines from the world of media, I'm Keith Parron.
From January 9th to the 15th in 2011, South Sudan held a referendum to become an independent state. On February 7th, the Referendum Commission published the final results. Nearly 99% of the population voted in favor of independence. On July 9th, 2011, the Republic of South Sudan was born. This part of Sudan has had a bloody conflict with the North for many years. People in the country want to turn it into a democracy, but there are still problems. The new country has no infrastructure. While it is wealthy in terms of resources, because of the political infighting, the country has no revenue. There's also the problem of who and which tribe will run the country, and it's a problem that won't be resolved anytime soon. Media censorship is also a problem. Journalists in South Sudan can be detained for up to 18 months before any charges are brought against them. Shortwave radio remains one of the most important tools to inform people about things like where a UN food drop will be, and also to provide information on dengue fever and malaria. Janice Law is a Canadian who spent 9 months in South Sudan training UN peacekeepers. She now joins us to tell us how radio in the newly formed state of South Sudan saves lives.
Good afternoon and welcome once again. In case you've just joined us, don't forget that from 3 exactly, we shall be hosting, Mr. Termajok, who is an associate officer within security sector reform. And we shall be discussing on military justice in South Sudan. As we all know that no sooner than later, South Sudan will be announced.
Well, we have to get used to saying Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan. Because, of course, Sudan is, you know, the northern part. They have radio stations in Khartoum, all censored by the government, like Radio Dabanga. Those folks for broadcasting about Darfur got disappeared, and Amnesty International were looking for them. Anyway, so Sudan and South Sudan. Whereas in the Republic of South Sudan, I mean, there's no infrastructure there. There's no drinking water. There's nothing. There's no information. There's no media. There's no newspapers. In Bor, which is the capital of Jonglei State, there's not even a newspaper, let alone, you know, TV or radio. and these small radio stations try and get on the air because they know the importance of information. Radio Moriah, the UN station, they do a good job of getting information out about human rights, about the elections, about the referendum, and a lot of social issues are really well covered by Radio Moriah. Thank God they're there. But sometimes that's the only media for miles around, repeaters. But shortwave is so important because the media is still restricted by the local governments. All the BBC and RFI and VOA, they might have stations, say, in Juba, but if the local government doesn't like what they're saying, they'll pull the plug on them. So I don't agree with international broadcasters being on FM in a country. You need to be on shortwave where you can broadcast into a country, you know, the news, the real deal, and regardless of what the local government thinks. So shortwave is so important. I mean, in places like South Sudan, there was nothing else. And there were shortwave radios in the trucks and the vehicles, and people would sit around in the evening and listen to the shortwave. If you wanted to find out what was going on in the world outside of the country and what was going on inside the country from the view from the outside of the country, shortwave was essential. I mean, it's ludicrous that these big broadcasters is so irresponsible that they'd be cutting back. I mean, for whom? To save on the money? I mean, you've got hundreds of NGOs struggling to help these people, but government, you know, organizations like the BBC, the VOA, Radio Canada International, you know, the big boys, Netherlands, Deutsche Welle, they need to keep broadcasting to these countries where there's a desperate, desperate need of information. Information can save lives.
And the interesting thing, though, is many of these broadcasters will say, well, we're stopping shortwave to go to the internet. Now, I was reading some statistics recently where they said if you take Africa as a continent as a whole, except for maybe South Africa, which is in a different situation, but as a continent as a whole, less than 8% of the entire population have access to the internet. And they said, well, we're building infrastructure, but all the experts are saying yes, but that could take 15, 20 years because everything is so unstable in many places.
Yeah, but even the internet, it's so slow. I mean, you turn on the computer, open up a web browser, try and download even Hotmail. You have time to go for a shower, go for supper, to come back before one of your emails open. It's extremely slow. Just because there's no infrastructure, there's nothing there. They don't have landlines. Everybody's using cell phones. And even with the cell phone dongle for the internet, we couldn't get it. You know, the cell phone towers were too few and far between. So there's no internet. That's ridiculous. And again, shortwave and radio saves lives. To hear that there's NGOs coming in to rescue you when there's intertribal violence, when there's a drought, when there's famine. To be able to hear on the radio, listen, World Food Program has set up a feeding station at this town. If the villagers in a village can have a crank-operated shortwave radio and hear that there's help maybe a few kilometers away, which way do they march with their families and children on their back and they march into the drought-stricken areas walking for hundreds of kilometers and dying on the way? Maybe they're going the wrong direction. If they could just get a shortwave broadcast that tells them the World Food Program is set up in this area, we can't get to you, but come to us, we'll meet you halfway. It can save lives. Mm-hmm. Information about malaria, about dengue fever, about cholera, about hygiene. I mean, basic education. I mean, it's so essential, you know. I mean, the maternal mortality rate in Sudan was like 1 in 10 at birth. It's some of the highest in the world. The infant mortality rate is huge. I mean, just knowing about, you know, how and where to get to prenatal care, that there's Médecins Sans Frontières, there's different organizations willing to give pregnant mothers care to help them save their lives and save their babies' lives. And they might be in the next village, but they don't know that because there's no way of communicating. You'd have a shortwave station, communicates in their language, and say, okay, well, the World Food Program, Médecins Sans Frontières, the NGOs are set up here, here, and here. They'll hear it, and they'll go, and they'll get help, and it can save lives. And where is our social responsibility? Where is the social responsibility of these huge broadcasters?
Well, you know, the other thing, of course, that's playing a very important role in Africa right now, and it's popping up all over the place, are small community stations that broadcast to a particular area that will, say, tell women, okay, this hospital is not too far down the road. And it's amazing how something that we take for granted in the West is, like you said, it's really important to people's lives, and it does save lives.
Well, of course, the local community stations are great, and as long as they're allowed to broadcast this information freely. But the minute the government comes in and decides they want to take over the radio station or they don't like what's being talked about, they're off the air. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Zimbabwe, where the radios were given out by the NGOs and the police were kicking in the doors and confiscating the radios. If you were found in possession of a shortwave radio or a radio period and you were listening to any other station other than the government broadcast, you know, you'd be penalized, you'd be beaten and the radio taken away from you. So community stations are great as long as you have the freedom of the press and the freedom of the media to broadcast what you want. But once they become censored, and once it decides the local government thugs in the area decide that they want to sell that radio in the black market for a couple of bucks, forget it. Your radio's gone. Mm-hmm. Who has the radios? Who's going to broadcast? What's the message? And who's going to broadcast the impartial message? Is it really going to be for the good of the people, or is it going to become for the good of the local political power? So, I mean, there's a lot of questions. Yes, community stations are great as long as they're allowed to do what they need to do.
Now, in South Sudan, what is the main language in South Sudan?
Oh, my. Okay, well, the official language is supposed to be English. The real official language is Juba Arabic. But there's 130 different tribes, which were from North Sudan and South Sudan at the time. And they speak Dinka, Nuer, Murle. I mean, the largest tribe in the south is Dinka. But there's Achole, there's Lakota, Taposa. There's so many different tribes. So most of the tribes, I mean, also the literacy rate is extremely high, especially amongst the women. Mm-hmm. There's like a 1% literacy rate amongst women, and there's maybe a 10% to 15% literacy rate amongst men. I mean, little girls aren't allowed to go to school for very long to learn anything because of the wealth that they provide in terms of the cow wealth, the dowry. Right. So a young girl would be shipped off by her father to a man to be married for 150 cows or so many cows, and the male in the family gets the cows. And basically she becomes the wife, which is the property of the man. She has no rights, and she has to stay at home and raise children, raise the livestock. Fetch water, build the fires, etc., and basically becomes a slave, a domestic slave. Mm-hmm. So the women are traded for cows, so there's no point in them going to school because that their fate is that they're going to be somebody's wife. And what's the point of them learning another language? Because they're never going to use it, because they never get to speak to anybody.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the state of gender-based violence and child protection in South Sudan is horrific. They're the most marginalized of the marginalized. You already have these people who suffered through war and famine and drought and corrupt governments. And on top of that, they're totally discriminated against as a gender. Mm-hmm. So it's a sad state of affairs, but the illiteracy rate is extremely, extremely high for everybody. So to get everybody on the same page in terms of what language, I mean, they speak English, the statutes are in English, but nobody can read it. And they haven't created the statutes in Arabic because they don't want to follow with Sudan. The North had everything in Arabic and forced them to learn Arabic. They speak Arabic, but they want English as a language for their new free democratic country. But nobody reads it or speaks it or writes it, so they don't understand any of what their new statutes entail.
So it's really going to take a lot of time.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of time. I mean, the UN is now on MIS-SS, the UN mission in South Sudan. There's still a mission in Darfur, which was, Sudan at the time, when it was just Sudan, there was the only country in the world that had two UN missions in it. Mm-hmm. The Darfur mission is still going on. The UN has been booted out of North Sudan, which was left of regular Sudan, and they're only in Juba now, in South Sudan. I mean, Juba's growing in leaps and bounds. It has to, because all the NGOs have scrambled out of Khartoum and now in Juba. But and to get in and out of Juba, you have to go through Nairobi. I mean, the flights from Europe used to go to Khartoum. So a lot has changed in terms of... Of course, now that they have their democracy, burgeoning democracy in the south, they were used to be all united against the north, but now it's like, okay, who's going to be governor and, the SPLA and the SPLM, and who's going to be the boss? So governors are fighting amongst themselves, tribes are fighting amongst themselves, police commissioners are fighting amongst themselves. So now the civil war was the north and the south, but now the south is independent. The civil war is beginning internally. And you see more and more tribal violence. You see more and more political violence between political rivals. So everybody's now struggling who's going to be in power. Is it going to be a Dinka president of the South? Is it going to be a Nuer president of the South? Right now, Salva Kiir is Dinka, and the vice president is Nuer. And then there's other people from other tribes who want to dominate. And still, Abyei hasn't been settled. The contested zone of Abyei, which had a separate referendum because of the oil wealth there, and the North is still claiming Abyei to be theirs. The South is claiming it to be theirs. There was disputes over who was allowed to vote because the resident tribe were for Southerners and the nomadic tribe weren't. There was some debate whether or not they were going to be registered to vote were Northerners. So the Northern government just bombed Abyei all to heck so that the resident people would flee and leaving no voters. So Abyei still hasn't been settled yet. And so there's that bone of contention. Well, that started another war between Sudan and South Sudan. Will there be a civil war in South Sudan? The oil has been cut off because the South Sudan's greatest wealth was from the oil, but the pipeline runs through Sudan, old Sudan, North Sudan, and they were not only charging them huge fees to export their oil, they were stealing the oil. So South Sudan has stopped the flow of oil into the pipelines through the north, but that was their only way of getting the oil out of the country. So they have no money. They have no income coming in because the oil has stopped. So now they have to build a pipeline out through Kenya and find somebody else to take the oil off their hands, or where's their source of income? So this new country, which was counting on the oil revenue, has no oil revenue. So it's just, and like, you know, the government employees are supposed to be taking a cut in pay, and people are getting paid, and, you know, poor people or angry people began to rise up against each other, and it's just, it's quite the volatile state. As it has been, it continues to be, but even more so than when I was there.
That was Janice Law talking about the important role shortwave radio plays in saving lives in South Sudan. You're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
We now have a little something we'd like to give away to one lucky listener. A notepad and pen from this year's SWL Winterfest that was held in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. The notepad and pen were made especially for the 25th anniversary of the fest. So, how do you enter? Well, we're going to run 8 interval signals from 8 different international stations from the past. If you can name the country and station, you'll be entered into the draw. Okay, so here goes. Again, what were those 8 stations and countries? Send your answers to MNP at PCJ Media. Again, that email address is MNP, stands for Media Network Plus, at pcjmedia.com for your chance to win a lovely SWL Fest 25th anniversary souvenir notepad and pen. We'll announce the lucky winner in 2 weeks. Now, time for propagation. Here's Dan Hensley, the Media Network Plus propagations editor.
On April 14th and 15th, we'll see a 10.7 centimeter flux of 100. From April 16th to April 20th, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 105. The A index will be 10 on April 14th, followed by an A index of 8 on April 15th. From April 16th to April 20th, all the rest of the week, an A index of 5. A KP index of 3 for the first 2 days of this week, that's April 14th and 15th. The rest of the week, from the 16th to the 20th, a KP index of 2. Sunspot number 1452 is passing out of view as of April 12th, with sunspot 1454 coming into view. We see a new and yet unnumbered sunspot developing in view as of April 12th. One coronal hole has been observed, and a flowing wind from this hole should reach Earth by April 13th or 14th. As of April 10th, 2012, some reports of a nighttime 19-meter opening came in, with reports of Australia and other far-off countries being heard in the United States.
Thanks, Dan. And with that, we've come to the end of our program. Thank you so much for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please email us at mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once more, mnp@pcjmedia.com. As well, you can download this program as a podcast, as well as past editions of Media Network Plus. At our website, just go to www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. So on behalf of Keith Perron and Dan Hensley, I'm Paulette McQuarrie saying so long and see you soon.